the recent problems with Shell Oil's vessels highlight some gaps in what we have on hand in Alaska to respond to these marine incidents. Shell's pretty much having to bring its own. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. If the Kulik had lost its toe in the Arctic Ocean, the Valdez, Kodiak, and Kachemak vessels would have been a lot farther away. Our statewide phone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. What is the state of our response capability and how do we get it to where it needs to be is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is a fast-paced situation, and we're going to have to move through the program really, really fast. So don't hesitate to call in and get lined up to participate at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. I'll do the best I can in keeping up with the emails as they come thundering in during the next hour. So we've tried to assemble some interesting people for you to engage with here to maybe just have a discussion that's a little bit more penetrating than your usual debate about whether or not we should drill in the Arctic and so forth. And with us is Brett Farrell of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. Brett, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Brett, why don't you explain a little bit what Marine Exchange does? And I understand you actually are involved as a contractor for Shell or have been with some tracking.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit. We call ourselves a nonprofit maritime organization. We're down out of Juneau. Most of our members are members of the maritime industry throughout Alaska. And one of our primary things that we do, one of the primary services we provide, is vessel tracking throughout Alaska using various technologies. We use a system called Automatic Identification System, AIS, as well as satellite technologies, and which kind of goes hand in hand with today's discussion, because if you're talking about response assets, you need to know where they're at, and that's kind of the role we've been playing so far with this. We have been working with Shell throughout the season as far as tracking their own vessels, and then as well as this incident with identifying response assets.
Right. Actually, there's some kind of online app that I haven't actually tried, but people were using it while the tow was going on of the Kulik to just track them themselves online.
Was likely our system. I believe Shell also has their own in-house display that we're sending our data to, but more than likely, if you were looking at an online system, it was our system that you were seeing.
All right. Well, thank you, Brett Farrell, Marine Exchange of Alaska, by telephone from Juneau. Also with us from Anchorage, Alaska, is Curtis Smith, spokesman for Shell Oil. Curtis, it's been kind of a tense little period of time for you professionally, hasn't it?
Yeah, good morning, Steve. It's certainly been a challenging week or 10 days.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you can join us for the program, and I know that you are going to be leaving again. You have to go on to other engagements here after about 10, 15 minutes. So I want to dive into a few things,
sure,
if we can, right to start with. The first thing is I am already assuming that there's two things you won't talk about. One is what's going to happen to the Kulik next, and the second is what happened to the engine on the tug?
So good questions, and questions, of course, Steve, that we have ourselves. We may have answers to both, but not right away. I'll start with the Kulik. As you know, it's now in safe harbor. So ROVs and divers will soon get underneath the hull to better understand its integrity. We've had a team overnight on the Kulik. So they probably had a really good chance now to look at all the chambers and to better understand what the damage was as a result of seawater getting in on that stormy night. So I understand it is compromised by seawater. I just don't know by how much. And of course, the next question there is, you know, what does that mean for your exploration plan going forward? So unfortunately, it's just too early to know that. We'll just have to see what the health of the Kulik is. Your second question was about the engine failure on the Ivik. What caused inexplicably four main engines to just basically die at a very critical time in this tow? There has been speculation that it was a fuel problem. Obviously, I don't know the answer to that. We don't know the answer because an investigation will have to bear that out. I will tell you that when new fuel injectors were used and the system was purged and a new fuel source was added, the engines restarted. So that may tell you, or experts out there, part of the story, but we have to hold off until we know for sure.
Well, we're all glad that the engines worked for the tow off of Sikulitik.
Yes. Yes, well, I had some time, of course, after the incident itself to do a full systems check and to make sure that the integrity of the Ivik was what it needed to be, because, of course, that was the next most important tow in its career.
Yeah. We're speaking with Curtis Smith, a spokesman for Shell Oil, and we actually don't really know what this will do for Shell's plans for next year, and Curtis, I think, is telling us he doesn't know either.
It's just too early to say. You know, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of decisions. But if nothing else, you know, we'll probably answer some questions here on this program. I hope to stay as long as I can. But I don't want to come across as ever trying to sort of mitigate what we're dealing with here, or coming across as making excuses, even as we answer questions, Steve. Because, you know, these events are something, of course, we take extremely seriously. And while we are relieved that there appears to be no harm to people, no harm to the environment, we're just very sorry that it happened in the first place. Frankly, Alaskans expect better from Shell, and so do we.
Well, you know, having been involved with, you know, elaborate enterprises involving engineering and so forth and new technology, there are times when stuff just doesn't do quite what you thought it was going to do. But I would have to say, you know, your statement there was well taken, in that Shell seems to have had more than its share of things that went wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, and we see the same optic, Steve. We understand the lens that's on us. You know, all of the events that led to a shorter drilling season, questions about our ability to operate in Alaska, we obviously take that to heart. And I think it's fair to say we're shaking our own heads a bit. We know we have a commitment to go above and beyond. We've made a huge investment in technology. And as we've talked about over the years, we have a lot of experience working in the Arctic. So why are we getting in our own way? We don't know the complete answer to that yet, but I promise you no one here is going to rest well until we have a better answer.
What is the advantage to Shell of being the front person for this entire region and this entire new field of drilling? Does this essentially mean that the company is hoping it gets in on the ground floor of some kind of bonanza? I mean, it just seems to me that it's so... There has to be, the prospects have to be really, really, really good to justify the expense that has happened already, and any expense that would have to be gone through in order to get a pipeline all the way over to TAPS.
Yeah. Well, good points. And, of course, they can't all be economic drivers, but that's part of it, right, the size of the prize. To your first question about being first, I think there are advantages to being first in terms of setting the bar, setting the standard. But again, when you're doing something like that, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on you to set a very high bar and to be essentially flawless, which we have not done. So we feel that pressure, and we understand that it's not just about Shell being first, but it's about making sure that others have an inroad to that business as well. Because obviously, if we can't get this right, given our commitment and our experience and investment, then it's going to be really hard for others to do the same. And so we understand that burden as well. That's an obligation we have to our shareholders, of course, but to Alaska as well. Imagine if we didn't do this right and somehow kept the offshore locked up for everyone. That's not acceptable.
not acceptable. Curtis Smith is our guest of Shell Oil. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. Also, by telephone, Brett Farrell of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. I wonder if any particular question comes to your mind at this point, Brett, for Curtis.
No, I don't have any questions. I've been following it all pretty closely. We've been working with Shell pretty closely, not only for this season, but the previous season a couple of years ago when the exploration first started up there. I think I understand the challenges that they're facing, and I'm pretty well up to speed. I don't really have any questions at this point.
Do we have an update on your response vessel, Curtis, that prevented Shell from doing anything other than top drilling this past season?
So that's a that's called the Arctic Containment System, and that's been worked through in Bellingham, Washington, as you know, having reported on it. It's a first of its kind system. We sort of tested this modern marvel in public, and when it didn't go perfectly at the end, everybody knew it. I'm happy to report that it's been certified and it's been classified. It's been rebuilt, or if you will, and we will have to demonstrate that for regulators before we bring it back to the theater. So we feel good about where that is. Obviously, it was late in coming and prevented us from getting to total depth in 2012. But that's, again, part of sort of being first. It's something we volunteered as part of our exploration plan. And once we did that, we were committed to it. So we're staying committed to it, and hopefully we'll see it in the near future. Steve, there's one thing I did want to bring up.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Curtis.
In your open, you talked about, you know, what would happen in the Arctic or the assets and bringing them all yourself. It's very true. You know, when we decided we wanted to work and make a business in the Arctic, it was clear to us we would have to bring everything that we needed with us, including search and rescue and oil spill response, and we did. So the vessels that you're seeing work in the Gulf of Alaska now on behalf of Shell, they were all, of course, in the Arctic, plus more, including helicopter assets. So they are different regions. We had different assets cascaded up on the North Slope. But again, I also want to give a lot of credit to the service vessel, the Alert, that came at a very, very difficult time and played, and I mean this, a heroic role in trying to keep the Kulluk off the beach. The actions that crew took on that night were hopefully will be chronicled someday in detail, because they were special. They were outstanding Alaskans, and I'm proud just to know they live here.
Well, I'll tell you, I noticed that Kaylee Thompson has been listening in from Poppy Mechanics, and she's the one to write the book if somebody's going to do it. So if you hear from her, you have to pay attention.
We had a reporter from Poppy Mechanics on the vessel this summer towards the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
He spent about four more days than he'd planned to out there, because, you know, the weather is always in charge, and we couldn't safely get a helicopter out. So I don't think he minded at all. Food's pretty good, but he got more of a ride than most do.
The food's pretty good. So I would think that Shell, Statoil, ConocoPhillips, and everybody in the industry is hopeful that there will be some movement on getting more Coast Guard presence up into the Chukchi area. We all know they're doing the best they can, Sooner or later there's going to have to be some kind of arrangement made for a deep water port, some way that these vessels can be based up there during the season. And right now, you guys are bringing up all your own vessels.
That's right. That's right. And that's sort of the burden of being the pioneer again. But we fully support the Coast Guard in their effort to gain more assets and more logistics, you know, bases on the North Slope. Because, look, it's not just about oil and gas activity, right? I mean, they were surprised a couple times this summer to see, this sounds crazy, but a version of cruise ships up along there. And that's a passageway that is forgotten about by a lot of people, but it's an important place in the world, not just for oil and gas. I will tell you, when our two icebreakers left the program this fall, they went home via the Northwest Passage. So it's not unique anymore to see that kind of activity. So, of course, the Coast Guard, they're outstanding in the job that they do. They're everyday heroes here in Alaska. And I would expect that they would have more and more presence in the Arctic. They could easily make that case. I expect it'll get more volume as time goes on.
Let's turn to Jack, joins the program from Point Hope, Alaska. Jack, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
All right, thanks. I'm the president of the tribe of the Native Village of Point Hope. We've been involved with concerns and dealing with activities for a very long time, since the mid-70s. And as a federally recognized tribe, you know, we have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government, and there are things that we should be allowed to and must have in regards to full faith and credit. And so our ability to regulate and our status as a government-to-government relationship should be implemented. And that is something that has to be put into place in regards to, you know, regulation and enforcement. And we've been trying to get this to occur in regards to our relationship and our functions and our participation in the Coastal Zone Management Program and the regulatory authorization that has been done by federal agencies that have been delegated to the state. And so the areas that are outside of the state is something that is of great concern and has to be worked on and honored in dealing with our regulatory authority, both on a regional and village level. And establishing a port in our area has been expressed a couple of years ago to the Coast Guard, because we're at the location where people go west or east, going up north or toward Canada or toward Russia. And if there's an incident, there's nothing that can be done, you know, and we're the closest area, and Kotzebue's trying to lobby for a port site to be able to do that. And they're an hour away by plane, so they're quite a ways away. So, you know, I just wanted to voice that, and it's interesting in regards to what is being said and who is hearing it. And who is saying it? And so us tribes are having a very difficult time expressing ourselves and being heard and being honored in regards to what our needs are and what is needed.
Well, yeah, there's almost a federal shell game going on right now with the BSEE and what they're supposed to be doing and what BOEM is supposed to be doing. But, you know, it all used to be the MMS. Now we've got basically BSEE has very, very few people in Alaska. They're almost exclusively in the Gulf of Mexico, and they say their job is just safety, and it kind of leaves you wondering about some of the jurisdictional things. Well, was this the Coast Guard, or is this so forth? But, Jack, let me ask you this. We have Curtis Smith of Shell on the phone right now. If you have any questions, are you getting along okay with Shell? I mean, they have said that they've been conducting outreach and so forth with the local communities.
We haven't been talking to Shell for a very, very long time. It may have been either an egotistical attitude that we had, and then we finally got together last summer, I think, just before they came up, and so we had, you know, our discussions as to, you know, what we were going to be reassured of. And so we finally talked, and we got, you know, a small update, although it was a very, very short meeting. It only consisted of 3 hours. And so, you know, we did express a need for a review of, you know, agreements that have been made and how it affects on each side, whether it be near the Canadian border, whether it be near us in dealing with migratory animals. We did indicate that there was a need, and we did ask for their help in regards to, you know, ongoing studies and things that were brought up in dealing with concerns such as the health of the seal. There were over 109 seals that were found dead between Point Hope and Point Lay, and the samples are still in the forensic laboratories and have not been analyzed as of last year in October, per Obama's cabinet member that was drafted from Alaska. I can't remember his name, wrote or something. I can't remember his name anyway. So we do look forward to, you know, getting some of those results. If we're not going to get, you know, very much help from the federal government, we sure would appreciate it from the from the industry, and we did express that in our three-hour meeting, and we will get together again and work out things, and I hope that we can all work together and make sure that things do work out, and that our government-to-government relationship and our regulatory authority is in place, and make sure that we move forward and do what we're obligated to do in regards to, you know, our governmental functions.
Yeah, I understand, Jack. And thank you for your call. You're talking about the unusual mortality incident, and it is still a mystery. We've done shows on this, and it's a puzzle for everybody. It's not like they haven't been trying. It's that every test that they've tried has not yielded a positive result. So that's what I know on that one, Jack. Curtis, would you like to? Sounds like Shell might have a little bit more meetings to be doing in Point Hope. You know, a three-hour meeting apparently not enough.
Well, I appreciate where Jack is coming from, and I appreciate how he expressed his views as well. You know, we've been to Point Hope a number of times. I think it's also fair to say there's been some tension in that particular village between locals and Shell for a number of years, and it's not always been easy to get in and to keep a meeting, but it's not because of a lack of desire. So when we do have the time to get on the ground and have that face-to-face, it's time that we really appreciate, and we exchange a lot of ideas. So the idea, of course, of going anywhere on the North Slope is not just about Shell getting up and talking at people. It's really about going there and really shutting your mouth and listening. And so we've tried to do that as much as possible. Hopefully we can increase the frequency by which we get to do that in Point Hope. But he brought up some really important things beyond just the face-to-face, which is, I think, hugely important. The science itself. We're all looking for a lot of the same answers when it comes to the ocean garden that we're talking about. So Shell has an agreement with the North Slope Borough to not only share the science that we're pursuing for permitting reasons, but also to really dedicate ourselves to finding or starting new programs based on what North Slope villages and leadership want to know about. In other words, we're going to be there anyway. What would you like us to study and provide to you in terms of data? That's happening. All the villages along the North Slope have input on that, and that's encouraging. I think that's the trend in terms of communicating and also adding value to locals based on the work that we're doing anyway.
Okay, yeah, but I guess, Jack, you would probably respond, well, dealing with the borough is not really dealing with the tribe, right?
That is correct, and yeah. KBRW is not airing this because they're preempted by a budgeteering for their education.
Oh, boy.
So that's probably why you're not receiving very many phone calls, and I hope that you reschedule another program so that you can hear from the people.
Yeah, I think that would be great.
That was the main reason why I called, was to indicate that. And
okay.
So, you know, if we could have another program and so that we can hear, you know, people express themselves, and I do hope that we move forward and be able to, you know, perform those functions that we're obligated to perform.
All right, Jack. Thanks a lot for your call from Point Hope, and point is well taken. I did not know that we weren't being heard up in Barrow. I guess Prudhoe were being heard, and maybe out of Kotzebue, but not out of Barrow. Curtis, you still with us?
I'm with you. I've got about five more minutes.
I'm enjoying
the conversation.
All right. Let's let Douglas come to the program from Anchorage. Douglas, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning. I had a question for the Shell representative.
He's right here.
Yes. What was the nature of the supplies that were airlifted to one of the tows that lost propulsion?
So I'm going to have to think back, there's been a number of lifts. So if you're talking about an airlift specifically to the IVIC, is that right?
Yes, because of alleged fuel problems is,
yes,
I think, what I read.
So one of those lifts, I can tell you, included new fuel injectors for all of the engines, which was quite a lift. Apparently it was thousands of pounds of product that was that expedited in from the Midwest.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is in rough weather, especially the Gulf of Alaska, I brought a boat up the Gulf of Alaska as well. Rough weather will roll a boat more aggressively, and any debris that's in the fuel tanks will be further suspended higher in the fuel level.
Sure.
And for all four engines to go out, one would conclude that only a fuel source problem would take out four engines and fuel injectors. So the question I have is, was due diligence made to ensure that you can change a fuel filter underway that traps that debris that's coming out of the fuel tanks? I think the Alaska people really need to know, because of the great risk that's associated with an event like this, was due diligence made in having many, many spare filters aboard, fuel filters aboard? I have had fuel filters clog, and underway, you shut down an engine, you put in a new fuel filter, you charge the system, and you bring that engine back up. Was that the case here?
So it's a great question. And, you know, the solution, as I mentioned, was fuel filters and purging the system. An investigation will bear out exactly the sequence of events that led to all of those engines being shut down. I think that we're all getting at the same conclusion, but we can't know that for sure until they test the fuel and take the downtime it takes to make sure that they understand the exact sequence of events. I would remind you that the IVIC was underway for several days in all kinds of weather before the engine failure. So while it seems logical that we're all going to the same place in terms of why it failed, I think we need to wait and know for sure what happened. But your point's well taken.
All right. I thank you for your candor, and Alaskans look forward to the results of that report. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, Douglas, as you know, the forensic team from the Coast Guard is working this. I'm sure Shell is avidly interested. I'm sure Noble is interested. And certainly Alaskans are interested, and I have a feeling it's also going to end up in court somehow.
Sure. Well, it's an interesting point, not the court part. I can't speak to that, Steve,
yeah.
But for him to go to the IVIC itself, I think is smart, because if you're looking at this series of events, depending how it's written up or how it's sort of categorized by folks, I would argue that it's not really a weather event. What we're looking at is a series of unlikely events compounded by weather. And it's my view that if you look back at the timeline, when the IVIC lost power, is when really things started to go downhill, if you will. Yes, tow lines parted after that, but right after the IVIC lost power, it's fair to say that we never got a perfect purchase on the Kulik again, or a really good tow line, the way you would in, say, calm water or in port. So it's understandable why those maybe didn't hold up under these stormy conditions, but it really all started, in my mind, when the IVIC lost its ability to propel itself.
All right. Thank you. And I can understand, you know, we're not going to have time in this program, Curtis Smith, to go down through the weather forecast for the various days and what the jet stream was doing and so on and so forth, which is kind of too bad, because that's also another critical issue, as you and I well both know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still greatly of interest. This is a long passage, and it was going to take an awful long time in conditions that most people are telling me you in no way can you predict 2 weeks of weather in the Gulf of Alaska.
No, you can't, Steve. It's a fair point. So if you've ever heard me say that we saw a weather window when we left Dutch, that was the best weather window we could see. And knowing, of course, that a marine forecast, especially this part of the country, or the world, really, is not reliable after a certain number of days. But you can only go with the best information that you have at the time. So it's certainly a valid question. I would point out that I've looked at the Marine Registry recently. There have been over 100 ships that have made that passage just in December alone. So I don't want people to start thinking that it's a ghost land out there, and it's every man to himself should you take that quote-unquote risk. We had made this tow before. We knew the weather would be very difficult, and the Coast Guard has said publicly, look, Shell had a good plan. They had assets that could do the work, you know, even given that storms would probably arise. But again, these series of events led to what we're talking about today. I don't want to present that as an excuse, because there are no excuses for this. We're just trying to get a view of it ourselves.
All right, Curtis Smith, I want to thank you very much for being with us on the program today. I know you have to leave us now.
Thank you, Steve.
So you know what that does. I mean, I'm sure you don't want to, because that means we're just going to kick you around for another half hour without you being here.
I understand, but we'll revisit each other on the air again someday.
All right. Thank you very much. Very good. Curtis Smith of Shell Oil. And Brett Farrell is with us from the Marine Exchange of Alaska and a whole host of callers. So I think what we'll do right now, Brett, is just before we even go back to you, go ahead and take our break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about increasing activity of shipping and oil and gas activity in northern waters and whether we're prepared to regulate and respond. And I think there's no argument we're not. So we're doing the best we can, but the fact of the matter is there's many shortcomings, and everyone will admit it. And I'm looking here now at the Aleutian Island Risk Assessment, which is a process that has been going on for a while, and notes that there are 4,500 ships going through Unimak Pass now every year. That's about 12 ships a day. These are international shipping passages for the most part. That's 12 ships a day going through Unimak Pass. And if you go down just south of the Aleutians, you see a similar amount of activity. And this is quite the pickup from what it was before. I'll tell you what, Brett Farrell of Marine Exchange of Alaska, that really opened my eyes. I had no idea this activity was growing so fast.
Yeah, it's quite a bit. In fact, I'm looking at our system right now, and there's a lot of activity as we speak in Unimak Pass and around the Aleutians. And I don't know the actual numbers on how fast it's increasing or not, but your numbers sound right, and that there's a lot going on out there.
Well, they've got it at 4,500, and they say that 2 years ago the state was estimating was 3,100. So that's an absolutely phenomenal rate of increase.
And some of that could come with maybe it's a little easier to determine the amount of traffic. Like I said, I don't know.
I could probably go back in the database and
validate all that. But I think most people are surprised to hear how many ships are going through there every day or week or month, depending on how you want to measure it.
Right. And then you go up and look at the Bering Strait, and you see a dramatic increase there, even more dramatic. But a lot of that is like research vessels, some of them going back and forth.
Exactly. And that's what we find is a lot of the numbers you hear, especially in the Bering Strait, the first thing you hear is various numbers all over the board at times. And then when the higher numbers are usually attributed to multiple vessels crossing back and forth, or a lot of the numbers went up this year just because of, like Curtis was saying, the number of Shell assets that were heading up there this year. So.
Well, speaking of Shell assets, let's join Chris. Chris joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris. Great you could call.
Thank you. Steve, good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I love doing this type of show where I don't know how it's all going to come out.
Good. You know, what I want to say is I wanted to commend Shell on their response and their openness and their eloquence of how they handled the whole situation. And I'm very impressed. And coming from a guy who lives in Wasilla, that probably doesn't mean a lot. But let me give you a quick little background. I worked on the Kullock in 91, 92, and 93.
Oh, wow.
back in the day. And the holes were called the Cublum holes. So if anybody wants to look it up, this isn't new. The Kullock was owned by Bodrill back then. And further, to add to my resume, and I apologize, I'm certainly not trying to toot my own horn. is I've worked in the Gulf of Mexico doing rig moves as well as anchor handling when I was a young man and pulled the rig through a hurricane. And I am now presently a chief engineer on large ships. So I carry with me maybe some status of experience that we can say I might know what I'm talking about a bit. But the seas that I saw, because of course I worked on the Culloch, I couldn't help but to be interested in it. I didn't want to see this thing fail. And the seas that I saw, and also looking at the military weather sites where you can monitor the weather, I've never seen seas that bad in the Bering Sea. And I've spent of my career, I'm 50 years old, and I started shipping when I was 18. I can safely say that I've never seen seas that bad in my career from what I was seeing from the pictures and the helicopters as well as the weather reports.
Oh, you're talking Gulf of Alaska, right?
Yeah, sorry, Gulf of Alaska. I apologize.
Yeah, it's okay.
I apologize. And I certainly, I spend time shipping on the Tustamina, which is an Alaska State ferry that plies those waters on a regular basis, and saw some very, very bad seas back, but nothing compared to what I've seen or witnessed with the whole Culloch incident present day. So Shell had their hands full, and that weather storm was not predicted. I mean, when it changed course and it hit, you know, unfortunately the fuel thing on the IVIC, that all remains to be, you know, worked out with the Coast Guard and the people who are going to do the investigations. But when you're shaking a ship up that much, and if there's any contaminants in the fuel, bad weather always exacerbates bad fuel. No matter what the situation is, bad weather means bad fuel if there's any bad fuel in your system. And as a chief engineer, I take my fuel very, very seriously. And I've been very lucky not to have lost all of my engines at one time by fuel. I have been in similar situations in bad weather where I've had fuel problems that became apparent because of contaminated fuel, but not on that scale. And the IVIC is a phenomenal piece of towing equipment. I followed it. I read about it in the trade magazines. And as I'm an older guy now, I looked on it and I was going, well, I'd love to work on that. But I'll tell you, I'm glad I wasn't there during that time.
Yeah, it seems like they just couldn't. Well, Curtis told us they couldn't get really a snug tow or a tow that didn't have slack after the engine failure. And I guess that's pretty easy to envision when you think about all the turbulence that was going on. And I myself have looked at the Jetstream map. We had a hell of a Pineapple Express coming in at that point.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things. In fact, when you're towing a rig like that, there's the catenary depth of your wire and, you know, surge gear, you know. But when you take out the fact, you know, a lot of times in some of the worst weather I've been in, we've had to back into a swell just to keep our catenary depth so that you don't break your toe, you know, your toe wire or your surge gear. And when you've lost power of your engine, then you're taking a rig that weighs 28,000 pounds, and then the IVIC, the weight alone, if you're on the backside of each swell, I mean, something bad is going to happen. I mean, you're going to break something. And it was an unfortunate circumstance, you know, just flat unfortunate. And, those guys, there's nothing worse than being on a boat in 40 to 50-foot seas. I could only imagine, and not having any power, just no air, trying to get these engines back up and running. Those guys, you know, just like the Alert, you know, the Alert, like Curtis said, amazing. You know, these guys, what they did, it was phenomenal. And
they were steering that thing, and they were trying to keep it from making it the sweetest spot of the beach.
and as a merchant mariner, you know, it makes me very proud. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, in this day we're trying to get rid of the cabotage laws and the Jones Act and things like that. It makes me very proud. You know that we've still got the stamina and the people that can do these kind of things. And you know, hats off to those guys on all the vessels that was involved in it, the Nanook and the Alert, as well as the IVIC. You know, I those guys did a great job. No matter what, it was just a bad turn of events for everybody involved. And Shell has handled it eloquently. And I certainly encourage the drilling, you know, to keep up with our own national resources and stuff like that. So, you know, hats off to them, man. It's been it was it was an amazing story to keep, you know, to watch, and I'm glad that they're nestled in the bay. And I could tell you all kinds of stories from the years I spent up there, but we'll pass on that. I just wanted to give my hats off to Shell, and you know, if they want to talk about it, have them call me.
All right, Chris, thank you, and you certainly eloquent voice of experience there, and I'm sure others will disagree with you, but a very powerful defense there. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
All right, Ron joins the program from Dillingham. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ron.
Yeah, hey, good morning, Steve. In light of just in brevity here, you know, I've been in Alaska since 79, mostly in rural Alaska. I've been a fire and EMS since 75. Done EMS training for East Solution Trust for many years, and around Bristol Bay, and just but I've seen so much over the years. But it just kind of, one thing I want to point out, it seems like we always, it's like a knee-jerk reaction. Every time there's a vessel grounded, like the Kullock or the Selandang IU or the recent vessel that just grounded near King Cove, full of frozen fish, people always talk about marine safety, and they always talk about, oh, we could have done this or could have done that. But I wanted to just bring something up to your panel of experts there, and it's too bad that Shell's Curtis Smith is not available now, but I'm not debating the fact it's quite apparent that the Great Circle Route is just increasingly being used, more and more shipping, and the Arctic is going to be explored more heavily, and we need that. I'm not debating the fact about offshore drilling or this and that. And this has been an ongoing battle for years, and we need the revenues to keep our state going, and. But I want to promote, and I just think we want to bring up what the experts might think. And I heard there might be something similar in Norway or Statoil had something going on, where we would start and not promoting the coastal marina the coastal management program. But we need something both on a federal, have federal government, the feds involved, since so much of it's offshore. Federal waters in the state, to where there would be a council set up where they would meet on a monthly basis of experts and marine shipping experts and user groups like Shell Oil or the Coast Guard and fishing groups, and where they would meet on a monthly basis to discuss shipping-related issues and look at safety-related issues in particular and be able to bring some recommendations to the powers that be, both the state and federal.
You mean
know. There's no one group where people, if you hear of a problem or know of a problem, there's no one place where you can turn to pass this certain information along to see it acted upon. And I think we need something like that, as we're going to see more and more Arctic exploration and development. And,
well, yeah, of course, what's always brought up, what's always brought up is it's like, well, we need something like the RCAC. The Citizens Advisory Council.
The RCAC down in Prince William Sound.
Right, and then they say, well, if you there's a big difference between the Prince William Sound, statutorily, between the Prince William Sound, jurisdictionally, between Prince William Sound and
state waters there.
And Cook Inlet, a big difference. And for some reason it became politically ticklish, the idea that we might want to some kind of Citizens Advisory Council elsewhere. But I think what you're talking about is something a little bit beyond that, where the officials themselves are also just having some kind of common point where they talk together.
That's correct. And Native groups and who are affected in the various regions where the development's going on need to be at the table as well. And it just seems like we can't just keep having a knee-jerk reaction every time there's a ship that gets grounded or some marine incident. We need to have an ongoing council of some sort that meets on a regular basis to discuss these issues and be more proactive and not just reactive.
How close do you think Brett Farrell?
I ask, is there any such agency like in other countries that, you know, Shell has been, you know,
good question.
It's a foreign country or a foreign company, and what goes on in the North Sea? What goes on in Norway and in the North Sea, England? And I've heard there's some kind of a council. I don't know if anybody would know something.
I believe there is. And Statoil, I think, was explaining some of that to us when they were, you know, making their pitch for their Arctic drilling to the news media not too long ago. But Brett Farrell of the Marine Exchange of Alaska, can you enlighten us on how much citizen advisory capacity there might be in other nations?
I can't speak to the other nations. Ron makes great points. I understand, we have harbor safety committees like you mentioned, we have RCACs. Everything seems to be at a port level that I'm aware of. In the areas that, you know, outside of our ports, I guess the closest thing I can think of that we've done is like the Aleutian Island Risk Assessment group that gets to the still meeting. But no, I'm sorry, I can't. I don't know what other countries are doing.
Yeah, and it's there's been a bit of a dispute about that between Rick Steiner and Shirley Marquardt, with Steiner saying, "How come you guys aren't moving?" And Marquardt saying, "Look, we got to figure out what we're going to ask for, and I want it to be very specific." And we were hoping to have Leslie Pearson on here, who is the consultant working on all that, but we're not able to get the connection with that right now. But I would think that there is an awful lot of work in order, like everybody says, "Oh, well, we need a tug." Yeah, we need a tug. What kind of tug? Where should it be? You know, these are not small questions.
No, this is a big deal. The whole discussion surrounding rescue tugs and the whole gamut of response and prevention in the Aleutians everywhere in Alaska is a big issue and very complicated.
Yeah, well, I am intimately acquainted with how CISPRI came to be created after the Exxon Valdez, and a lot of it was just those people in Saldovia said, "No, we're not taking no for an answer. You want oil spill response capability? We're going to go find it. And we're going to have it sitting right here in Saldovia for you when you need it. And you're going to have to pay us to keep it here." And that worked out fairly well. And it does seem that sometimes somebody just has to need to grab hold and say, "Okay, this is the way it's going to be." Well, our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. A fascinating discussion of activities in marine activities, marine casualties, and whether our regulatory structure is adequate for the increasing activity that we're having as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik. PROVimaging.com. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at ArcticWireRope.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about offshore activity and response capabilities and regulatory framework. Emily Jeffers of Center for Biological Diversity chimes in by email saying, "Steve, how many disasters, mishaps, and failed tests will it take before we realize that no oil company can safely drill in the Arctic?" Comments coming in. Matt in Sitka, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Long time no see. Thanks for the show. I just wanted to point out that the Bering Sea in the wintertime is a much different place than the Bering Sea in the summer, and that statistic that 4,500 vessels per year, you got to know what time of year they're moving through the Bering Sea, and the same in the Gulf of Alaska.
Okay, well, just hold up on that, Matt. Brett Farrell, can you give us kind of a picture of how seasonal this shipping traffic is through UNIMAC?
Like I said, they're moving today. I'm looking at several of them going through right now. I don't get the impression that it that Great Circle route anyway. The traffic through UNIMAC Pass that it is seasonal. It's,
yeah, the
you know,
ice,
trade goes on and they plow through.
Yeah, the ice usually doesn't get that far enough to get in the way of that. I wouldn't think.
Sorry. What?
The ice of the Bering Sea, the pack ice in the Bering Sea.
Oh no, I don't think it's an ice issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Back to you, Matt.
The weather is a lot worse in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah.
I live here.
Oh, no doubt about that. I can't argue that one a bit. I've sailed. I've done my time in the Bering Sea in summer and winter, and I'd much rather be there in the summer.
I just see those pictures.
That's all I had. It's just here. And lately, the weather patterns. I live on an island out of Sitka. And so we're in, and I'm also a commercial fisherman. I'm on the water just about 365 days a year, and the weather patterns in the last few winters have been a lot worse consistent in my part of the Gulf from the east, a lot of east winds that if you get offshore, the conditions are much worse than the predominant southeast northwest we used to have. And that should be taken into consideration, the change in weather patterns in recent years, if you're going to tow a drilling rig in December in the Bering Sea. Well, that's all I have, Steve. Thank you very much.
Hey, Matt. Yeah, thanks a lot. Of course, that was the Gulf of Alaska where the tow was taken out of Dutch Harbor and on south. Let's go to Alan, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Alan.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. Yeah, calling from Homer. And, you know, I just wanted to make a comment, and basically, you know, I've been around Alaska for just about 37 years and been all over the state commercial fishing, you know, Aleutians, the Bering Sea, the Gulf. And, you know, I've been in a lot of incidences in different weather, and I could elaborate on it, but the point is that I want to make is that in those experiences over the years, I leave port as prepared I can. But I still have had the unfortunate happenings of incidents. And through those incidents, I learn not necessarily what to do, but what not to do. And I can take that to the oil industry. Like, take Exxon Valdez. Now, I would venture to guess that Exxon is never going to knowingly put someone with an alcohol problem like Hazelwood at the helm of a super tanker. And so we've learned
then,
a lot of things.
And then have him aim the damn thing to shoot the gap and go below.
Right, right. And, you know, the Exxon isn't going to do that normally. I wouldn't think so. And so,
he would have got it up to sea speed faster, man, to save money.
Right, right. You know, and you know, I mean, yeah, you know, mariners do heroic things in extreme conditions, and I commend those. But, I mean, it doesn't happen without the plain act of stupidity and greed.
So your point, Alan, I'm getting lost in trying to find your point here. You're saying we learn from these things. Whenever you were in a frontier, you're gonna have incidents because you're doing something that hasn't been done before, and we need to learn from it.
Well, that's one thing, but just say, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the fuel system on the tug.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, something happened, it ran out of fuel, or there's not a backup fuel filter system. You never shut down an engine to change fuel filters if you can prevent it. You have a backup fuel filter system. You switch over to a clean filter, and then you clean out the dirty filter, and you move on. You don't even miss a beat.
So I mean, there should have been more tug system capability on this tow, you're saying.
Well, I don't know what the fuel system is, but,
no, but
something human error, gross human error happened. And it will probably never happen again on that tug. And so my point is that they learned from it and they dodged a huge bullet. And what were the safety, the preparations done? And the equipment used, was it the right equipment? So that, my point is that they dodged a bullet. Exxon didn't dodge a bullet. And we're very fortunate that they were able to have the result they are now having. And I commend the Mariners, but I don't like put them on just as the Shell guy said on the radio after they got it off, no one was high-fiving.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't think I'm high-fiving the Mariners. They're going, holy cow, we dodged a bullet, and we're extremely lucky. That's what the deal is. And to, you know, romanticize or to put the Mariners or Shell in some sort of heroic framework is not what my thought patterns is, and that's basically all I have.
Thanks a lot, Alan. Great call. Bob joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Yeah, good morning, and
morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I'm just a flatlander. I was born and raised in the interior of Alaska. But, you know, I watched this program that Shell put out about a year ago about all the technology that was going into these Arctic drilling rigs and all the safety procedures in case an ice floe would come along so they could cut loose and be towed to safety. Well, you know, I've never been out in the Bering Sea. I've been out in Cook Inlet, and I don't think I've ever been in the open ocean, but I'll tell you one thing. I firmly believe that anything man-made or designs, Mother Nature is going to throw a punch at it and show us how small we are. And I think that's just what's happened. Unless we have a couple of aircraft carriers parked right offshore here to tow something like this in, I heard two very functional words just a moment ago, lucky and greed. You know, we weren't lucky. You know, when I first heard about this, I'm thinking, oh, boy, that's just what we need to get jobs going around here and cook in this again, let's have an oil spill. I mean, I say that in a facetious way, I guess, you might say, but... No, I made
money off of it, Bob. I don't know about you.
What's that?
I made money off of Exxon Valdez. I don't know about you.
Well, I was outside when that happened. I went out to see the world and came home here about 12 years ago.
Yeah. Well, your point's taken on that. Yeah.
But I guess a lot of people did make money. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, even people in Cook Inlet here. If you had a boat, you made money. But, you know, I haven't been to Valdez since I was a young boy. We used to go down there and fish for silvers in the summer and or in the fall and stop at Thompson or the glacier there up in Thompson Pass and get glacier ice to keep the fish cold on the way back to Fairbanks.
Yeah.
But, you know, I understand there's still oil. You dig down in the places down there in Prince William Sound and you'll still find oil down there. It's killed all the microorganisms that live under the rocks and along the beaches and stuff. And it may look the same, but it's not the same.
Boy, you're not the first one to say that. Bob, I'm going to need to say goodbye. We're out of time.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Bob from Soldotna there, and thank you very much, Brett Feller, for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks,
any closing thought you'd like to put out there?
No, I just I think it really didn't get hit on too much during the – I know the title of your program today was more of, or do we have
a, are we adequate?
Yeah, do we have adequate response assets? And I don't know if this case was a good example of, you know, like you said, Shell had just about everything they needed in close proximity. Fortunately for this, our stance is I would never say that, you know, Alaska is as huge as Alaska is, that we had adequate, that we're always going to have adequate response assets available. It's one of the things we're really, that we find is very important is knowing what is out there. And for instance, we got the call very early on in this incident from Shell, just as a contingency plan. They knew obviously what they had available that was going to be available to respond to this. But they called us early on. We always try to know exactly where all the tugs in Alaska are and
great
capabilities. And
you were a big help, Brett, and I want to thank you so much.
I like to think we were.
All right. Thanks also to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge, and we'll be back again next week. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.